Hello again, Dan Roderick of the Baltimore Sun here with Roughly Speaking, episode 413, all about food from the sea. Summer in the Chesapeake region usually means a crab feast or two, and people in Maryland and Virginia are always wondering what the local supply looks like. We should have a clearer picture in August and September, but the Maryland Department of Natural Resources reported earlier this month, that is in late June, early July, that the male crab population declined by nearly one-fifth for the second year in a row, with the harsh winter cited as one reason and the scarcity of young crabs last year another. Still, overall, the stock of crabs is considered healthy, and the Salisbury Daily Times reported that the adult female crab population remains well over the level that scientists would consider dangerously low. We're used to hearing reports like this and living with the ups and downs of the Chesapeake blue crab and crab prices. It wasn't that long ago that the Chesapeake Bay Foundation characterized the crab population as, quote, perilously close to collapse, end quote. And at another point, the regional Chesapeake Bay program said the crab stock had been, quote, fully exploited, end quote. The crab population needs vigilance. There's no question about that. Monitoring by scientists and careful management by resources experts who work for Maryland and Virginia. Today's show goes beyond the Chesapeake to bring you two seafood stories, one about a cousin of the blue crab, I guess it's a cousin, lives up north, the lobster, the Maine lobster, another about the most heavily harvested fish on the East Coast, menhaden, and the multi-billion dollar industry connected to the omega-3 fatty acids that come from the oily fish. My guests are authors of books published this summer, Christopher White, who looks at the boom and bust of Maine's famous fishery in a book titled The Last Lobster, and Paul Greenberg, whose latest book is called The Omega Principle. I'll let Paul explain the title. What is the, in your mind, in your definition, the Omega Principle?
Well, I guess on one level it's clickbait, because I think, you know, it's very hard to convince people to read about the ocean and about fish. And I did kind of like that the title had a sort of science fiction, you know, side to it.
So it is.
Maybe somebody looking for a thriller will pick it up. So there is actually a principle behind the Omega Principle, and that is that, you know, we have been progressively making ourselves sicker and sicker with the food that we eat and trying to kind of supplement our way ourselves out of that dilemma. And I would say that the Omega Principle is a way of changing our eating patterns so that they lean towards the sea in a way that's better for both the land and the ocean. So in a big mouthful, that's what it is.
What you're trying to address here, well, so many things. How do you sustain a resource? How do you use the resource? How do you use it to enhance the Western diet that we've adopted? And basically, what is sustainable in the world in terms of the fish we eat, the seafood we eat?
What everyone knows about seafood, when you ask people, you know, why they eat seafood or where, what they think they're getting from seafood, they'll all point to the same thing. They'll all point to omega-3 fatty acids, you know, the supposed miracle supplement. And I was on book tour last week, and I remember somebody asked a question. And he said, you know, I used to take salmon, but now I take herring. And I'm like, you take it or do you eat it? You know, this is this, like, very funny idea we have about seafood.
Right.
But when I, you know, went back and looked through, because the book, The Omega Principle, isn't just about supplements, it's really about food systems. And I guess the conclusion that I came to is, you know, the way that we get food for the so-called Western diet requires this tremendous burden on the planet in so many different ways. And what I surprisingly found out was that leaning more towards the sea and embracing a set of principles for both harvesting and growing from the sea, and also changing our land food practices, could lead us into greater balance both for the planet and for ourselves.
Paul, I'm holding in my hand a white plastic bottle with a black cap and a green label. It says Advanced Health Formulas, Miracle Plankton, Marine Phytoplankton 5000, and it also has with it moringa leaf and barley grass. It says unique superfood formula. There's 60 capsules in the bottle. It says take 2 or 3 in the morning, 2 or 3 at night. It doesn't really say why. It just
why not?
Why not? So what am I holding in my hand here?
Well, I haven't seen that particular supplement, but my guess is whoever packaged that stuff together has been hearing the buzz around plankton, around phytoplankton in particular, because I think what a lot of listeners probably don't know is that omega-3s are not actually made by fish. They're made by phytoplankton or microalgae, and those are really the sort of the grass of the ocean, the very base of the food chain. And we can, in fact, make omega-3 supplements from plankton, and it might not be a bad thing to do because we can actually grow phytoplankton in the presence of sunlight at very little environmental cost. So that's not a bad thing. What you're holding in your hand, though, to me sounds like a little bit of a concoction of buzzwords. And, you know, one of the things about researching this book, The Omega Principle, was that I did go to a lot of supplement conferences, including the Global Organization for EPA and DHA Fatty Acid Conference at the Ritz-Carlton in the Canary Islands, you know, such is my life.
Nice.
And, you know, what I just was sort of very struck by how, you know, supplements are not altogether medicine, and they're not altogether food. They're what an author of a book called Natural Causes called a hermaphroditic category. They're neither food nor drug. And as such, they don't really require the kinds of medical testing that actual drugs or actual food require. And so there's all sorts of things that can be said about supplements without breaking the law.
Considering all the research you've done for this book and the earlier books, are you convinced that this is a good thing? That omega fatty acids are good for us, are necessary, that we should be eating seafood in whatever form to enhance our diets?
I mean, the best I could come up with in an all-encompassing theory of the omega-3 is that it's the Forrest Gump molecule, insofar as, you know, you've seen Forrest Gump, right?
Several times.
Yeah. So, like, Forrest, you know, Forrest shows up at these really important moments in history, but you're never quite sure, is Forrest making the moment, or is he just there? And that's kind of like the omega-3. Like, look at the brain, for example. The human brain is as much as 10% omega-3 fatty acids, which is a lot. I mean, the human brain is basically a piece of fat on a stick, and a lot of those fats are omega-3s. They also do show up in all sorts of reactions around inflammation. The big question is, humans existed for 300,000 years before dietary supplements were invented. So the question is, you know, do we really need to have this? Surely we evolved as creatures on this planet with the ability to find omega-3s in our diet and in our just normal way of living. Why suddenly are we having to supplement our bodies with this compound that occurs naturally in our food systems?
Why indeed? Is that just a product of marketing?
Well, you know, marketing is everywhere, mm-hmm. but there's also some science behind it. I mean, one big idea out there is that there's not just the omega-3, there's also another omega called the omega-6. And the omega-6 actually competes with the omega-3 in the human body when we eat vegetable sources of omega-3. And there are these short-chain fatty acids that we'll get from leafy greens, from flax, from walnuts. The human body actually can elongate those short-chain fatty acids into the long-chain fatty acids that we put in our brain and also that we use for heart health. The theory is that because we eat so many omega-6s, and omega-6s come to us from corn oil, from soy oil, from feedlot animals that we're eating more and more of, the idea out there, the sort of theory is that perhaps, or I should say hypothesis, is that maybe because we've so overloaded our bodies with omega-6s that we need omega-3s to kind of counterbalance that. And there's a lot of talk in supplement world of, you know, the ideal omega-3 to omega-6 balance. I came away from that conversation. I think it's interesting. I certainly found people who thought it was bunk. I mean, nobody disputes that those omegas do compete, but whether the balance is really that important is a question. But what I did find and what I sort of did in the book was to look at, you know, to use omega-3s and omega-6s as larger metaphors for food systems. So you have your omega-3 systems, right, which are, you know, your wild seafood, some farm seafood, leafy greens, small farms, and that whole world. And then you have your omega-6 systems, which is big corporate agriculture, soy and corn, too much grown in our land, too much feedlot animals that are causing all sorts of problems with water quality and obesity and all those kinds of things. So I guess what I came away with the idea was maybe we shouldn't necessarily be supplementing ourselves out of what is essentially a food system problem. Maybe we should really need to be looking at our food systems and trying to change that rather than to boiling down, you know, 20 million metric tons of little fish into tills every single year.
And Paul, just a little bit on aquaculture. So how does aquaculture fit into that picture you just described?
Well, you know, there's a lot of controversy around aquaculture, of course. You know, a lot of people don't like the idea of growing fish or shellfish. But actually, aquaculture, when you compare it to land food production, is much more carbon efficient, much more freshwater efficient, and much more open space efficient. Because remember, you can grow seafood in 3D, right? Land food is basically a flat plane, but you can go into the depths with aquaculture. So I think we have a kind of reticence as a nation to get involved with aquaculture. A lot of it comes from shore owners. I'm sure that it occurs in the Chesapeake, where people don't want to actually look at the buoys and the gear that's involved in aquaculture from their expensive country houses. The U.S. is currently 17th in overall pounds of farmed seafood produced, but that puts us behind North Korea. So I think it's pretty bizarre, especially since the United States controls more ocean than any country on Earth, that 90% of our seafood is imported, a lot of that being farmed aquaculture, often from Asia.
So we need to ramp that up in order to reach this omega principle that you're describing.
Yeah, I would say let's ramp up aquaculture. Let's do it in a sustainable, science-based way. And if possible, let's ramp down on land food production. Another interesting thing that I came across in doing this omega-3 research was that it turns out that grass-fed land animals, you know, cattle, chickens, pigs, and so forth, they have a higher omega-3 value in their flesh than grain-fed animals. Now, that brings you to an interesting conclusion. Okay, it says, okay, well, potentially that land food meat would be healthier for us if it was grass-fed. But it turns out that grass-fed animals, you know, we can't make that many grass-fed animals. It's much less efficient just from a sheer land use point of view to have that many grass-fed animals out there. So what that says to me is, why don't we reduce the amount of overall land animals that we're eating, make them grass-fed, and then if we need more protein, bring in that protein from the ocean, from sustainably managed wild fisheries, and from aquaculture.
Several years ago, here in the Chesapeake region, we started hearing about Omega Protein, capital O, capital P, a name of a company out of Reedville, Virginia, a fleet of ships harvesting
and big
menhaden.
Continue to clash over the most important fish in the Chesapeake Bay. Good evening, I'm Stephanie Harris.
And I'm Laura Caso. Menhaden plays a key role in the food chain of the Bay and the supply chain of a multinational corporation. Ten on Your Side's Chris Horn has investigated the industry for the past 3 years and has the latest developments now. Chris.
Yeah, menhaden's a food fish for larger fish and sea birds and sea mammals. It's also a key ingredient in worldwide commerce. And no one catches more menhaden than Omega Protein. Company operates out of
and I remember and says, when I first started reading about this company in the Sun and other journals, it was like, oh, here we go. You know, you've created this market for omega fatty acid products, and we're going to just overdo it. Watch out, everybody. Here it comes. And then there was a period when the menhaden population fell by a significant percentage, and then a debate struck over catch limits on menhaden. Until we reached a sort of equilibrium, it seems like. That's, in brief, the history of what's been going on here the last 20 years or so. It's still, it always makes me wonder, you know, what is sustainable? When something is in abundance, we kind of go crazy.
Well, I would addend your abbreviated history by saying that omega protein actually existed in different forms for different purposes long before the omega-3 fatty acid became the trendy supplement.
Mm-hmm.
Omega protein's primary business is reducing menhaden fish for animal feed. 80% of all the reduced wild fish out there go for feeding aquaculture, actually, for salmon and things like that. Previously, they fed pigs, and previously, before that, chickens, and then they were also used for fertilizer. The American Indian word for menhaden, I can't remember, it's meshatunuk or something like that, but it's, you know, from which menhaden was derived, means that which fertilizes the land. So Native Americans actually used menhaden as fertilizer way back when. But your summary of the debate is basically right. Bruce Franklin wrote a great book called The Most Important Fish in the Sea, which really focused on omega protein and the menhaden and the historically very high catches of menhaden that occurred particularly in the middle of the 20th century. Catches have backed down from that super high point, in part because the fish aren't there. And when you speak of an equilibrium that we may have reached with omega proteins harvest, they did reduce the total allowable catch a few years ago, but it's been creeping back up again. And I think, you know, you have to look at the underlying premise of the whole thing. Every single fishery out there will tell you that their fishery is sustainable, and omega protein has told me as much. The Peruvian anchoveta fishery people have told me that's the largest fishery in the world, again, mostly going into reduction industries for animal feed and supplements. I think, though, if you collectively look at this entire reduction industry, it removes from the ocean 20 to 25 million metric tons of marine life every single year, boiled down into fish meal and fish oil. That's a lot of fish. That's the human weight of the United States taken out of the ocean each and every year. If we were to keep that 20 to 25 million metric tons in the ocean, I think we would see a lot more larger fish that we like to eat, but also a lot of, you know, other things that have value in a more aesthetic way. Marine mammals, seals, whales, all these things rely on these little forage fish that we are, you know, as I say, boiling down into oil and dust at the rate of 20 to 25 million tons a year.
Well, that gets me to a point I wanted to discuss with you, given the previous books that you wrote. When we talk about sustainability of a wild resource, because Menhaden is a wild resource,
yep,
we tend to think of it in terms of, can human consumption be sustained? Can we continue to harvest these fish or lobsters or whatever you're talking about and maintain a sustainable population while still satisfying human consumption? But that leaves out the other consumers of that fish, the other fish in the ocean, for one thing. We have to ensure that enough menhaden remain behind to sustainably feed the other fish in the sea, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and this puts us in the direction of something called ecosystem-based management, which the people who are fighting omega protein have been arguing for over, you know, over a decade now, if not more. And that idea is that, you know, when you're managing a fish, it's, you know, the usual way of doing business with the ocean, if you're a human, is, you know, a total allowable catch or maximum sustainable yield, meaning like this is how many fish you can take out 1 year and hope to have enough breeders left in the water to produce the same amount of fish that you can catch next year. But as you say, this does not take into account all the many consumers of these little fish. And, you know, especially when we're talking about these little forage fish, menhaden, herring, sardines, it's a much more complicated question. And, you know, rightly so, the industry sometimes criticizes ecosystem-based management because people still haven't quite figured out how do you do ecosystem-based management. How do we truly take into account all the needs of these other creatures out there? But I guess what, you know, to tie things back to market forces and the way humans behave beyond the ocean is that what I found in the research for the Omega Principle was that there were actually so many different ways of dealing with the need for the things contained within these forage fish like menhaden. There's so many different ways to now get that stuff into the industrial food chain without harvesting wild fish. Like, I came across this amazing creature called the black soldier fly, which actually we can set on top of food waste. And keep in mind, Americans throw out a fork full of food for every fork that we eat. And if we were to put those black soldier flies on that wasted food, that actually can be transformed into a meal 98% as nutritious as fish meal. The black soldier fly larva is a bug. And what it really likes to eat is rotting food. And fortunately, the United States has tons and tons and tons of rotting food. And that creates a huge landfill problem. It creates, you know, public health problem. What's interesting about the black soldier fly larvae is that we could actually put those onto all that food waste. And I've been to some of these black soldier fly farms, and they're not even really farms. They're not very big. You just have to get some food waste to them. And they grow incredibly fast. And then the grubs that hatch out, that feed on that food waste, can then be milled down just like you would a menhaden or any other wild fish, and you end up with a meal that is 98% as nutritious as the meal that you get from harvesting wild fish. And to me, this is such a no-brainer. Like, why are we killing lots of wild fish that are keystone species for the marine ecosystems when we could be actually solving our food waste problem by just using a little bit more technology and a little bit more savvy? I mean, as I say in the book, we shouldn't be solving 21st century problems with technology that hails from the era of Herman Melville.
Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dan. It's nice to talk to you again.
Paul Greenberg is the author of two earlier books about seafood, Four Fish and American Catch. I interviewed him when both of those books were published. His latest book, The Omega Principle, is published by Penguin. A short break for a message from our favorite bookseller, and then we'll hear about how climate change brought boom and could bring bust to the North American lobster industry.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
On Wednesday, August 1st, the Ivy and the Baltimore Creative Alliance host Amber Tamblyn, whose debut novel, Any Man, challenges our understanding of rape and the experience of trauma, while also searching for hope and a space for victims to be heard in the darkest of places. That's Amber Tamblyn, author of Any Man, at the Creative Alliance on Eastern Avenue in Baltimore at 7 p.m. on August 1st. Now to our second story about seafood. The Last Lobster is Christopher White's latest book. Christopher White grew up in the Chesapeake region, and I was introduced to his writing in a book from 2011, Skipjack, the story of America's last sailing oysterman. For the new book, Christopher White spent a lot of time in Maine, specifically Stonington, Maine, for a look at the lobster industry and how climate change has affected that fishery. It's a fascinating story that explains the lobster boom of a few years ago when we actually saw prices come down a little bit. And it tries to chart what the future holds as ocean temperatures rise. Lobstering on Long Island and Rhode Island. There used to be lobsters off of Long Island and Rhode Island. What happened to that fishery? I think if you answer that question, we get on to, you know, what's happened to lobstering in general.
Yeah, and in Maine, yeah. So it's that's a fascinating question because the situations really are parallel between Long Island Sound and Maine. But, of course, what happened in Long Island Sound began happening about 10 years ago and sort of set the stage for everything that's coming up the coast. So in the 1990s, Long Island Sound experienced higher temperatures, and because of those higher temperatures, the population of lobsters increased and really boomed for a while, for a few years. But then the temperature kept increasing and got over what they call the lobster threshold, which is 68 degrees Fahrenheit, which means that lobsters are very stressed at that temperature. And once the temperature got above that in Long Island Sound by 1999 and afterwards, the lobsters were in deep trouble and started to die off. They also got shell disease, which is prompted by high temperatures, and just died from exhaustion. So that first happened there in Connecticut and New York, and then it progressed and moved farther up to Rhode Island to Narragansett Sound, and then farther into Massachusetts, Buzzard Bay, and it's just been going up the coast. So the fear for people that I spoke to in my story was, could this happen in Maine too? In Maine, for a long period of time, the lobstermen put forth the theory that it had to be predators that were the problem with lobsters booming, because predators like cod and pollock and other groundfish that are traditional consumers of baby lobsters and larval lobsters were on the decline because of the over-harvesting of those fisheries. And if those fisheries were on the decline, that meant that lobsters could start to boom. So that was one theory, but it didn't really stack up compared to what was happening with warming in both Long Island Sound and also the Gulf of Maine. When the boom really happened in Maine, it was in 2012, when the temperatures were very high, both in the wintertime and the spring, and the temperature of the Gulf of Maine climbed about 5 degrees higher than it normally was. And that meant that the lobsters began to molt earlier. Rather than molting in July and August, which was just in time for the summer lobster and tourist season, they began to molt in June, which meant that they came way early and there was no market for them because they molted before the season really had happened. So that was the first thing that happened. Then there was repeat molting, which meant that rather than an adult lobster molting once in the summer, they began molting two times in the summer, maybe another time in the autumn. And that repeat molting and early molting meant that there were more lobsters coming into the breeding population, and so the population grew. And third, there was early maturation. The females especially, which traditionally only in years past reached sexual maturity once they were of legal size, about 7 or 8 years old. Now they were maturing at 5 to 6 years. And so I've been many times out with lobstermen on the Gulf of Maine, and they bring up a small lobster that they can't even keep in their boat. It's too small, but it's full of eggs because she's been able to reproduce much earlier. So all that means that there were more lobsters coming into the breeding population, and the population was able to boom.
So climate change contributed to this boom that occurred in Maine. Now it may be contributing to a bust.
Yeah, that's the strange thing. I mean, the irony is that the same factor that brought on the boom can bring on the bust as well. It's just a matter of degrees. So in Long Island Sound, going back to that story, they had a boom in the 1990s, but then come 1999, the temperatures were too high and all the lobsters began to die. And it continued for years, so that in 2013, the state of Connecticut proclaimed that 11 million lobsters perished in the month of August, which was about 98% of the population of lobsters in Long Island Sound. And so the fear is, could that happen in Maine? I mean, it's a lot cooler in Maine, it's a lot colder, but still there's the possibility that it could hit us there as well.
Do you run into climate change skeptics? The people who harvest lobsters, are they at all skeptical about whether climate change is contributing to this or not?
As far as the skeptics go, yeah, I did a book tour the last couple of weeks in Maine, and I had a couple hecklers come to some of my book signings, so yeah, that's happened. And then as far as the lobstermen go, I found that when I started this story in 2014, there was a lot of silence about the prospect of climate change and ocean warming and not much acceptance of it. But in the last couple of years, just because there have been so many scientific studies coming out that say that ocean warming is really what's going on here with the lobster population, so I think the lobstermen are beginning to accept it.
Well, lobstering, like a lot of industries that involve a resource, goes boom and bust, right? I mean, I remember growing up in New England myself, some years the lobster prices were good, sometimes they weren't so good. Sometimes the supply was good, sometimes it wasn't. But here, in the case of Long Island and Rhode Island, there's no other explanation for why that bust became permanent.
Exactly. So, yes, most fisheries go in certain cycles of boom and bust, but this is a more profound downturn that happened in Long Island Sound. And last year, after the boom that Maine has experienced over the last 5 or 6 years, from 2012 to 2016, last year in 2017, the harvest decreased by 16%. And started to plummet. So, you know, we'll see what's happening this summer. The prospects haven't really looked very good for lobstering this summer so far, but we'll see what happens.
And the tracking of the lobsters puts them up further in Maine than they've been traditionally, right? There's actually movement of the lobster populations.
Well, this is really the remarkable thing. I really didn't know the extent of this issue when I first got into this project, and it really fascinated me. I got in touch with a professor at Rutgers University named Malin Pinsky, who got his PhD at Princeton, and he did a survey of 360 marine species in the North Atlantic and discovered that all of them, every single one of them, was moving northward. their population was moving northward. See, all marine species are temperature sensitive. So the, you know, the laying of eggs, the sexual maturity, mating, everything is cued to the to temperature. And so where they position themselves in the habitat, ocean habitat, also is dependent upon temperature as well. So what's happened is in 1968, the center point of the American lobster population was centered off of Island Beach, New Jersey. And in 40 years, it moved north of Boston, which was something like 176 miles that it moved. And it's still moving at 4.3 miles per year, which means lobsters are just steadily progressing farther and farther north. And there's even the fear among various scientists that lobsters could move towards the Canadian border, and then what happens? If the American lobster was out of reach of the American lobstermen, where are we then?
So when the boom occurred, 2012, 2013, there was all this abundance of lobsters and then room for more lobster men and lobster women, right?
Yeah.
You write in your book about people who invested heavily in boats so they could go offshore and harvest lobsters.
Yes.
What's the future look like for them? These are folks who secured boats and equipment all on credit.
Well, that's true. When the boom happened, there was a lot of overconfidence in lobster villages up and down the main coast, like Stonington, where I spent all the time for my book. And there was wild spending going on. They were buying bigger boats and hiring larger crews, buying bigger homes and bigger trucks, and getting overextended. So there is trepidation right now. What's going to happen if the 16% drop in the lobster harvest that happened last year is repeated this year, so that it gets down to about a 30% reduction or close to a 50% reduction? Banks are going to start to repossess their purchases.
Another thing I wondered about was the demand for lobsters. China importing millions of pounds of lobsters. This is a natural resource. How long can it be sustained when the demand increases? You know, there's more affluence in China. Importing lobsters for weddings and events is a big deal over there now. I mean, I don't understand how we can sustain that.
Yeah, it's part of the boom, really, because during the boom, the exports of Maine lobsters reached over 400 million pounds, which is about 70% of the harvest, which means of all the lobsters caught in Maine, 7 out of every 10 of them are going overseas. People don't realize that. And so they're going to Europe, they're going to Asia, they're going to Korea, China, Vietnam, and the lobstermen and the buyers and sellers in Maine have become more and more dependent upon those exports.
It just doesn't seem sustainable.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. I don't think it is. I agree with you.
Does a higher price affect demand? I mean, isn't that the way the world works?
Well, yeah, usually if there's a larger demand, the price can increase.
If the price is higher, demand drops, no?
Yeah.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about the tragedy of the commons, because this is really interesting. It gets to the whole question of how you manage a fishery so that it doesn't collapse, so that people can still make a living. There's a big question here about how you do that. Once upon a time in Maine, the waters were wide open. If you got a license, you could go out and lobster just about anywhere, drop your pots and have a good time. Those days are gone. How is it done now in Maine?
Well, it's really a closed fishery, which is one of the things that people that were critics of the tragedy of the commons when it came out in the 1950s said that, you know, if you have a closed fishery, you're going to protect the resource to a greater extent. And so what happened in the 1990s was the state of Maine created 7 lobster zones off the coast. And if you live in a certain town on the Maine coast and you're a lobsterman, you have to participate and only fish in a certain zone. And that prevents you from going over to another zone and overfishing.
You know, in Maryland, watermen always seem to resist any kind of regulation or any kind of restriction that's put on fishing grounds or the seasons. That happened in Maine, or did they all buy into this?
They bought into it, and the reason is, Dan, is because the zones, the lobster zones, the closed fishery, are based on the lobster territories that have been in existence in Maine waters for over 150 years. Lobstermen and lobstermen families all have territories where they fish and put their traps, and they prevent other people from coming into their territories by either vandalizing their gear or shooting at them or pulling a knife or whatever it takes to keep other lobstermen out of their territories. So those territories are they're not on a map anywhere. They're not on a chart. They're not delineated by buoys or anything like that. It's just that all the lobstermen know that go out on the water, like, for example, into Penobscot Bay, they know where their territories exist and where they can fish and where other people cannot invade upon them. So that was basically the premise that the state of Maine used to create these lobster zones, which are sort of superimposed on the territories. The territory still exists, but on top of them are these seven lobster zones. Any one of those seven lobster zones might have 100 territories within it.
So this says to me that in the face of the tragedy of the commons, which says people are basically selfish, and if you open a resource to everybody, they will exploit it. People are not future thinking. They think in the moment. If they see abundance, they take as much of it as they can. If they see open territory, they take as much of it as they can. They bring their sheep, they bring their cows.
Right.
So actually managing a resource is an answer to that.
Yeah, and yet there's been a lot of work by economists through the years to try to come up with solutions to the tragedy of the commons. One of those solutions has been to have a closed fishery or a closed resource area, mm-hmm. so that you only let in a certain number of fishermen or farmers or cattlemen or whatever it is that you're going to let in. You limit the number of the access so that the commons is protected.
Well, so there's no other way to manage a resource. Otherwise, it's a free-for-all for everybody, and the resource disappears.
Exactly.
Bill Burton, who was the outdoors writer here at the Evening Sun for years and then the Morning Sun, used to say that we can't handle abundance, that humans can't handle abundance. When something is big and plentiful, we just exploit it as far as we can, and we don't think about the future. And that's really kind of the tragedy of the commons, isn't it, that you get locked into this short-term selfish behavior, the greed, and you don't think about the long-term consequences.
That's true. And, of course, the abundance can mask what the problem is, because the problem really becomes more prevalent when you have fewer resource items out there to gather or to fish from.
Well, this might seem far-fetched for anybody, but what about, I guess the ocean doesn't belong to anybody. Why couldn't you divide it up, the bays and the areas where lobsters are, and sell off, you know, farm like it was farmland? Why couldn't you sell off territories to people?
Well, they've done that in other countries. Like in Asia, they do it extensively. In Japan and China, they lease off different areas of a bay or a sound, and people farm it. The only real instance that it's happened in the United States is in Maine with these territories, where they weren't officially or legally quadrant off, but the lobstermen themselves have claimed their territories, and they manage them themselves.
What do you think is going to happen, Chris? You think that fishery is just going to keep moving northward with climate change?
As Malin Pinsky calls them, the lobster velocities or the climate velocities that are moving northward are going to continue. And it could, according to the arithmetic that I worked on, something like in 30 or 32 or 35 years from now, the majority of the American lobster population is going to be in Canada.
What about a moratorium? Does that idea ever come up? You know, in Maryland, we had the rockfish moratorium. It brought back that fishery.
Yeah, well, of course, moratoriums do work, but they work mostly when you have a situation of overfishing and a tragedy of the commons where overfishing is in play. The problem in Maine is not overfishing. The lobster actually is not overexploited. Something like 52% of the total population of lobsters are harvested every year, which is well within the realm of safe fishing. So there isn't a problem currently, but of course, if the crash happened that scientists are currently predicting in Maine with lobsters, then there could be a serious problem of so much effort out there of the lobstermen out on the water, and there could be overfishing coming along. Right now, there are lobstermen in Maine are allowed 800 traps per boat, and there are 4,000 lobstermen in Maine. So if you do that arithmetic, you come up with 3.2 million traps on the ocean bottom in the Gulf of Maine. That's an awful lot of traps.
I went to Maine when I was a kid with my good friend growing up because most of his family was up there. So we went up to Kennebunkport. His name was Bobby Philbrick, and his uncle was Longley Philbrick. And I mean,
wow.
I mean, this was the real thing. This is the, how you doing? Yeah, you coming over for supper? And so I just want to tell you, Uncle Longley went out and built a bulkhead for a woman whose husband was a lobsterman. And he came home with a burlap bag full of lobsters as a payment for building the bulkhead. So we had a feast, one of my memories of growing up and visiting there. What do you think is the most important thing you learned from the people who actually do this for a living, the families you got to know in Maine? What jumped out at you? Because I remember you write in the book about spending summers in Maine in your youth. You came to appreciate the lobster, the lobsters and the blueberries of Maine. But what about these families that actually do this for a living? Do they're realistic about what all this means, that they acknowledge climate change? They suggest that their grandchildren go into the business, or they tell them to do something else in life?
Well, they have been telling their grandchildren to go into the business, but some of them are reserved about that in the last year or two with the downturn that happened last year. I found that the lobstermen of Maine have one thing in common with the watermen of the Chesapeake Bay, and that is that they're content living the life that they're living. They love the life that they're living. And I found that skipjack captains and Maine lobstermen both have no desire to have a better life. They don't want to move to Manhattan. They don't want to have a bigger car or a bigger house. They just want to do what they're doing and do it as long as they possibly can. And that sort of contentness really strikes me, I think. And the other thing that is powerful for me with the lobstermen of Maine is that they seem incredibly resilient. They seem very flexible in how they go about life. Like right now, with the problem of climate change coming into their fishery, what is the option for them? Well, the only option for them to recover from that is to diversify. If they can not just harvest lobsters, but go into other fisheries and harvest other fisheries, that would perhaps be sustainable. And one of the lobster captains that I went out with, Peter Miller, has just bought into a scallop farm, and he's going to raise scallops in aquaculture to try to have a more sustainable way of living besides just lobstering.
And in the New York Times, just a few days ago, I read a story about a woman who lobsters, and she's getting into an oyster farm.
Yeah, there you go. The fishermen of Maine are very dependent upon one species, and they really have essentially a monoculture. And you know how dangerous that is for a farmer to have a monoculture. It's similarly dangerous for a fisherman to have a monoculture, because if something goes wrong with that one species, you're in deep trouble.
Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
Christopher White is the author of The Last Lobster, Boom or Bust for Maine's Greatest Fishery. And there's a question mark at the end of that subtitle. The publisher is St. Martin's Press. That's our show. I'm Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.